allow us to talk about two things. Three things, but one was thrown out. Creative imagination, the creative was thrown out. And followed. I think they may have something to do with each other, so we'll treat them both together. How do we derive the word father? Very simply, F to P, add an E on the end, change the A to U, and you have put here. Simple, isn't it? A father is a bloke that goes about putting here and putting there whatever he's got that's worth, or he's not worth putting. The Pitri, the fathers of the ancient Hindus, and the Pater of the Greeks, and the Pater of well-educated English boys, are, of course, all the same. But the word means put power differences. To put power differences. That means, quite simply, to differentiate power. Now, Christ said, call no man father on earth. You have one father in heaven. Now, heaven is defined as power. From the verb to heave up. When the original infinite power condensed itself to form the world, it pressed upon centres, and the centres pressed back to a certain distance. And where the powers coming in and the powers pressing out balanced, that zone of balance is called heaven. You notice in the book of Genesis it says the firmament is called heaven. And the firmament is the place where two powers meet and press. To be firm, you have to have two powers, and you have to press. You press inwards towards the centre, and the centre reacts and presses outwards. And at a certain distance from the centre, there is a zone of equalisation of pressures. The inward pressure is called Saturn. The outward pressure is called Jupiter. The zone where they meet is called Mercury. Now, Saturn is pressing on to centre. Jupiter is pressing away from centre. Mercury is the zone of balance between. And you know that Mercury, the Roman Mercury, is the Greek Hermes, the Egyptian Thoth, the Hebrew Messiah. So the balancer of power is the Messiah, the Saviour, the Redeemer. In every situation, it's the one that holds the balance of power. You can easily see why you should call no man father on earth, because no man on earth knows enough about power to be able to put it effectively anywhere. Power is the rate in science, a rate at which you use energy. Energy is that which does work. It's a Greek word, the erg. Erg is a unit with which you measure work. Energy means in work. Affirming. The thing that does that work is a force applying itself to some situation which is also an energy of another order. When energies rotate, they make matter, and when energies translating move along and strike against the rotators, the result is work. Work equals some kind of change induced by an applied force. And it's a very important concept. Let's hold in mind that no one is called father unless he has the power actually to put something in full awareness of what he's doing consciously. Now, I don't know any physical men who know enough about biochemistry to design the head of a sperm. Never mind the tail of it, and the motor mechanism, the head of it, complete with hereditaments, DNA double spirals, etc., etc. I don't know anyone who knows that much. So quite strictly, no man on earth whose girlfriend or wife has given birth to a baby could really claim to have put the baby there, because he didn't put the sperm there by his own personal effort. All he could do, under impulse of certain energies about which he knows practically nothing, he could react in a dizzy manner, and his whole organism be mobilized so that some of these clever entities called sperms manage to find a way out and find their own way to where they're going. And finally to bore a hole in an incipient ovum and fuse together with it and conduct a process of interrelating that results in another human being. Now, unless that particular physical man had manufactured that sperm on purpose, complete with all the biochemistry in it, all the energies, all the pattern, and unless he had driven it specifically to a given ovum and driven it into it and conducted the whole process, he would not be legitimate to say that he was the father. So really, it is a term of grace to call any man on earth father. You call him father because you don't know what else to call him, except when he's not there. Now, if you accept that fact, and accepting truth frees, know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, you can go on first name terms with those beings who think that they are your mother and father. It might be nice to ask them first, do they mind? If they mind, you can ask them polity or something, especially if they're very wealthy. Continue to say mummy and daddy. In fact, I had a marvellous experience yesterday. I was coming home from Toft Hall, and as I got down the Nutsford Road, I wasn't supposed to be late, incidentally. And there was a magnificent Rolls Royce, an original ghost from 1923, in the middle of that Nutsford Road, and the man waved to me. And as he was stopped, I thought I would stop as well and have a little word, you know. So I stopped the car, got out and went up to him, and he started to reverse. He was not in dire straits. He was about to reverse into his house by the mere. And he himself thought that he was a father. And he informed me that he was going to sell his Rolls Royce from 1923. It's an antique. A magnificent thing, the spotless engine. He had the bonnet up. Everything was going like this. Sounding and looking just like a Rolls. No vibration. You know, you could put a something or another on the bonnet and it won't fall off. No vibration, and he was going to sell it. Why? Because he thought he was a father. He had what are called children, which is very interesting, and they have to be educated. Now think of that magnificent car having to be sold. I said, you have the mirror at the back of your house. Throw the children in there. Now, because I'd only just met him, he was a little blinky about that. But then suddenly he smiled, he realised. Then he said, it's a little late, their education is nearly finished. Meaning, if you commit yourself to something, you might as well finish it for the sake of your own dignity. But if he had, a long time ago, realised that he was not the father, he might have said, who is the father of these creatures? And he might have done what he called saying prayers. Dear, really responsible person, what are you going to do with these things you've posited here? Are you going to provide for what you call that education? And immediately there would have been a sort of, what it calls in the New Testament, raising, a lifting, a seizure of these creatures, and they would have been lifted up in the sky in rapture and vanish back to heaven. Now, we haven't usually got that much faith. And without faith, it is impossible to please God. So somehow we've got to get it. Isn't that right, Michael? Yes. I always appeal to authority to back me when I'm in a difficult situation. Now, the important thing is this. Once we have thoroughly accepted that we are on earth, not parents, legitimate or otherwise, it can help to relieve you if you know that, especially about the illegitimates. But what we are is creatures of our Father. That's a very strange thing. A lot of people, quite nice people, think that all human beings are children of God. Isn't that a general feeling? Or if you like to translate it, they think that they are children of the universal power. Let's put it that way. There is a universal power and we are all creatures of that universal power. Sounds very nice, doesn't it? We're all children of the universal, the almighty power that made cosmos. And then a funny Jewish gentleman, Jesus, comes along and says, you are not children of God. Unless, although this power, this infinite power, has made everything, nevertheless you are not children of that heavenly power, that heavenly Father, except under one condition. And if you are not under that condition, you are of another Father. The condition is belief. You have to believe that God, who made the universe, is your Father. Because if you don't believe it, the generative power in you will not be His. That's strange, isn't it? There is an infinite power. All things have been made by it. Without it, was nothing made, as it says in the prologue of the Gospel of John. In the beginning is the Word. The Word is with God, the Word is God, and the Word made everything, and without the Word, nothing has been made. And then along comes the Word incarnate and says, but unless you believe that proposition, you are not generated by that Word. You are not generated by that heavenly power. You are generated in your action by the power in which you believe. Now the Pharisee says to him, we have one Father, God. God is our Father. And he says, no, He is not. Because you don't believe in Him. Your Father is the devil, a liar. Because you do not believe in that cosmic power. Now here's a very funny way of dividing the world. You can divide the world into two kinds of beings. Those who believe that there is an intelligent, personal, universal power which has made the universe, and those who do not. And you can put a knife right between them. And there's what is called in the Bible an unpassable gulf between those who believe that the cosmos has been made by an intelligent power and those who do not. Simple. Those who do not are today generally roughly believers in evolution. They believe that once upon a time there was a non-sentient, that is a non-feeling, matter, material particles. These material particles, each one of them with no sense, non-sentient, non-feeling, non-volitional, each one of these particles is moving about in space at random, fortuitously. And by accident, some of them happen to get together and clot and make some kind of substances, amino acids, whatever you care to call them, proteins, protoplasm. And gradually, as the thing became more and more complex, then there appeared in it intelligence as a result of increasing complexity. Now, I'm going to ask you seriously to consider this. If there is no intelligence in the beginning of the universe, and the universe is made of some kind of material particles, atoms or subatomic particles, if each of those particles is unintelligent and cannot feel and cannot think and cannot will, can you, by putting those together in accidental clusters, cause the appearance of intelligence, of feeling and of will? Now, if there is anyone who thinks that that is so, and they please put their hand up. Is it possible to conceive that original particles that cannot feel, cannot think, cannot will, by simply putting them together, suddenly acquire this peculiar talent of knowing that they exist. Is there anybody that believes they can? Shall I take silence as an agreement that we cannot conceive it? Excuse me, one hand went down.
No, I have to doubt it.
You have to doubt it. You have to doubt it.
Yeah. I mean, the conditioning processes of strands, we are affected by them, and it is wrong to say that I haven't got this doubt.
Very good. It's a very funny thing, because this afternoon a bloke said to me, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "The subject matter." And he said, "How are you going to approach it?" And I said, "I'm going to approach it beginning with sentient power. And I'm going to ask them if they do not find it inconceivable that there would be non-sentience becoming sentience." And this fellow said, "I know one fellow who won't believe it, Arthur Burbitz." And wasn't that funny? It actually happened, that Arthur. I said, "Well, you see, he's been trained. He's been trained by scientific thinking in his medical education. And it's very, very helpful for this discussion." Because Arthur said that he couldn't be really honest unless he expressed this doubt. And this is very, very important. We're going to talk about fatherhood, the power to put things, and we're going to talk about imagination, which also means I make. The power to put things. And Arthur said, in strict honesty, because he's a nice fellow, he can't help being honest. Been in trouble on many occasions. I said, "That happened to Arthur." There is doubt in the human being. Now we're going to find out the source of this doubt, because it is very germane, or German, as the case may be, to the subject matter. What is the origin of doubt? The word means doubleness. We already hinted at it because we said that the infinite power presses in and creates a center. Now that when it presses in and creates a center and the center presses back, it doesn't press back infinitely, otherwise the thing would vanish. It presses back so far and then the incoming power meeting it creates a balance. That balance is the mercurial zone, we call the balance of power, the firmament, heaven, whatever term you care to call it. And we have the condition of doubt, doubleness, because we have a precipitated center, and we have an infinite beyond. And mysteriously, both the infinite and this finite encapsulated zone are in consciousness. That is, we can conceive consciously the infinite and the finite. We can also do another thing. We can do what is called identifying. That is, behaving as if we were either one or the other, or both. If we behave as if we were the saturnine compression, we become egotistic. See, I'm sorry about that. Did that look like Magnus Pike? The theory of influence will be spoken about on another occasion. Here we are. The saturnine compression power pressing on the center can be identified with, and when we do identify with it, we create what we call the egoic consciousness, finite. We can think of ourselves as finite. I can deliberately concentrate on this suit that somebody gave me and think whatever is inside this is me, impregnable in my armor, as opposed to the outside world, beyond the infinite. And I can say this part inside here is important. The rest is of no account whatever. When I make that statement, I'm being egotistic. If I say that everything inside my skin is very, very important, and anything elsewhere is not important to me, then I'm being egotistic. But at the very same moment that I do it, I'm aware that there's an infinite beyond me. So there is double presentation. Now that double presentation is the origin of doubt. And I must make pronouns to Arthur for drawing our attention to it. Doubt is in the human being. It is quite dishonest to pretend that it isn't there. Now, on the other hand, we could think, really, I'm infinite. I remember a particular fellow who was talking about the infinite, about the world of things being an illusion. Maya doesn't really exist. Indian philosophy says the existential world is Maya, it is illusion, it isn't there. And a particular student said to this Indian professor, do you mean that the bomb that fell on Hiroshima wasn't there? And he said, yes. Now, to be consistent, he said it wasn't there. Just another illusion. Suppose you have an illusion of 750,000 people and you wipe them out in a few seconds. They're not there. It's an illusion. Now, it is a point of view dependent on the usage of certain terminologies. And the same thing that isn't there, if you change your terms, is there. Like by the law of Maya, when Shankara was teaching a certain king that all was illusion, do you remember the story? The king thought, well, I will just test him. So he had a mad elephant let loose, and the elephant chased Shankara, and he shinned up a tree out of the way, and then the king had the elephant caught, and then he went out and stood at the bottom of the tree and said to Shankara, tell me, if all is illusion, why did you run up the tree when the mad elephant came out? And he replied, looking down calmly like yogis do, like Maharishi does when you say, why are you a millionaire? Ask my manager, it is none of my business. Shankara said, precisely because of your involvement in Maya, you think you see it usually me up, it usually tree. And then he came down for lunch. Now, consider this very carefully. Arthur pointed out that he had doubt. He was honest. Now, if we're going to control ourselves, we must be honest. We must admit what we've got. And then we must examine the source of the doubt. The source of the doubt is simple. Before there was a concentration, before there was a creation, creation means encapsulation, there was only the infinite, and it was doubtless. Doubtless. The infinite is doubtless. And this is a very important point. The infinite is doubtless. But the same doubtless infinite can posit, by catalytic act of will, a finite. And immediately there is doubt. That is doubleness of presentation and the possibility of disparity, of despair. The thing that worries all the existentialist philosophers. Despair means disparity, and that means doubt. Presented in consciousness as this marvelous doubleness, a finite self-encapsulated being and an infinite beyond. And when you look in the book of Genesis, you read that in the beginning God made the heaven and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Now many thinkers have said, oh, what on earth? Remove on earth. What caused this silly situation? Why was there darkness upon the face of the deep? Now the great thinkers and the Bible scholars and the great religionists of all great religions have a story about a fall. Not the fall of man on earth, another fall in heaven. God himself is an illimitable light. Light is consciousness. Pure awareness. Its symbol, light. Pure awareness. Spotless, immaculate. The woman clothed in the sun in Revelation. Spotless awareness. And this awareness would have remained doubtless. providing it did not create. But it did create. It created, first of all, spheres of light. Now imagine a universe with no dark matter in it, no inertia, no heaviness, no grossness. Supposing all our bodies were to be changed, which is quite conceivable, into light bodies. You know when you burn coal in your grate? If any of you are lucky enough to be able to do that these days. When you burn coal, the heat and light that come out of the coal were once upon the sun. Because you know perfectly well that that coal is compressed, that is saturninely condensed, compressed solar energy. The plants of a few million years ago took the energy of the sun, and through their chlorophyll in their leaves, they captured that energy in an act called photosynthesis, and they wrapped the sun's energy up, and they took chemistry out of the air and chemistry out of the ground, and wrapped it up with the energy from the sun, and then put it under very great pressure, and it became what we call coal. It coalesced. Then when we put it in the grate and put a bit of heat to it, all the energy secreted from the sun starts to come out. So that piece of black coal is condensed light. And that is true of every particle of matter that we know, including our own bodies. Our bodies are condensed, saturnized light bodies. And just as at a certain critical point, that great light pressed and then blackness, coal. So at a certain critical point in evolution, there was a condensation. Physical bodies appeared where there were previously only light bodies. Now, in religious terms, in all the major religions, the bodies of light that were first created, before there was any gross earth, those bodies of light are called angels and archangels. Archangels are sort of boss angels, because they have a big arc that encloses and controls other spheres of light. When we talk about the angels, we are talking about spheres of intelligent light, just like sunlight, but the light fields itself. It is a plasma. We will now coin a term to remember this by. Photo is Greek for light, isn't it? False. Photoplasm. A photoplasm. That is, a certain amount of light. You know, we can measure the pressure of light from the sun when it falls on the earth. Millions of tons of light fall on the earth in the form of photons every day. And plants capture it and use it to make trees and things. Let's call a packet of light in its modelability a photoplasm. Let's call all of it the photoplasma. It's modelable light substance. It is exactly the same as an angelic body. And our own bodies, our living bodies, are made in the same way. They are photoplasmic. They are light bodies, and by compression and slowing down, they appear to be what we call gross physical bodies. And they have developed, through compression, inertia, which makes us feel often very tired and very bored. But when they were in their light form, when that photoplasm was not too condensed, when it was made with the delicate pressure of the infinite spirit, there were an infinity of spheres of light. And each sphere of light had its own intelligence. Now the definition of a person in the major religions is this. A person is a zone of sentient power that can think and feel and will. By think we mean formulate. You see how important this is when we come to talk about imagination. When you think, you formulate. When you feel, you evaluate. You evaluate, do I like it? Do I dislike it? There are only two kinds of value, like and dislike. The evaluative process is simply determining, do I like it, do I not like it? And then, think, feel, will. Will means initiate a change. Start some process. Now, a zone of power that can formulate, evaluate, and initiate is a person. This is very, very important for what we're talking about. Any zone of power that can think, feel, will, that is to say, formulate, evaluate, initiate, is a person. But every one of these spheres of light that were created by the infinite before there was a gross earth, every one of those spheres of light could think and feel and will. That is, it was formulated, could formulate itself, evaluate its own condition, like and dislike what was happening, and could initiate changes. It could distort its sphericality and move about. By simply changing its shape, it could induce motion. This is very important. You know, the shape of a fish, a normal fish, is a double wedge. And the pressure of the sea upon that double wedge allows that fish to move with remarkable speed because of the shape of the fish. In the same way, those primary spheres, which are intelligent persons, zones of power that can formulate, evaluate, and initiate, by distorting their own bodies in a field of pressure, they move about. Just like some fish come to the surface. What was Jess telling me about her wicked fish hiding at the bottom of the pond, and then they come up and lie on the surface. If you keep very quiet, you can see them. And now they tense, past tense, present tense. Now, they lie there, and then if they think you're watching, quite suddenly, they go down. They don't do anything, apparently. What they do is sink downwards. That's all. They formulate a downward direction. Then they feel downwards. They alter the balance of forces inside them and they sink. It's as simple as that. If you ask them to write a little paper on that, in order to be allowed to enter a great university, they'll go bloop and disappear. They have their own reasons for that. Human beings, with their tremendous conceit, think they have no reasons. But they have. Now imagine, before the gross earth is made, before the book of Genesis starts, there is an infinite power, and this infinite power is gently pressing, creating zones, and each zone can feel, evaluate its own condition, can change its shape and initiate motions. And it is called an angel. It's called an angel because an means an undulatory motion. The G in it, gamma, means to condense, and the L means God. So it simply means that God, the L function, condenses himself just enough to make a sphere differentiated from other spheres. Now obviously when he makes these spheres, he will have lots of little spheres, and then larger spheres, and then larger spheres, and the larger spheres are the great archangels. Those can feel the motions that are going on inside of the smaller spheres, and the smaller spheres are called the little angels, and they have various names. There are hierarchies of angelic powers. Real powers, not fairy stories, real powers, real personal intelligences. In the same way that we have inside our bodies cells that are little zones. You can have a toothache, a tummy ache, a belly ache, a toe ache, whatever, headache, whatever you've got. The cells in that part feel it and they send you a message. You can get that message, you are the archangel, they are the angels. And in the same way in cosmos. Now, because of the hierarchy of differences at the angelic level, it followed that some of them were small, and some of them were large, and they had all different colours, and some were relatively brighter than others. And, because of hierarchy, one was the brightest of all. And the name of the one that was the brightest of all was Lucifer. Lucifer means light bearer. Lucifer. light bearer. He was the most marvelous archangel. He was absolutely tremendous. Look at him, it was staggering. Because he was like a, what can I say to be most like him? The cheapest jewelry from Woolworths. Sometimes you find a solitaire. Now here, to hold it up laterally to the light like that, you see it's clear glass. You see straight through it laterally. But if you look at it like that, what they've done is spray the back of it with certain colours. And these colours reflect through the facets. So that it literally dazzles you with a multitude of colours. You know the kind of thing I mean, the cheapest trinket, which has the most marvellous colours. Now, Lucifer had within him, remember, he's a great archangel, lots and lots of little spheres. So when you looked at him, you looked into him, and the different colours of all these different spheres are all lit in their own way, by their own function. Some specialise in formulation, some in evaluation, some in initiation. They're all doing something. They're dynamic. They're not static. So they're continuously foozling the observer with myriads of brilliant lights. This is not a figure of speech. It is a statement about a fact of a certain being called Lucifer, the light bearer, an intelligent being who contained myriads of other beings inside him and many other beings outside him also. But he was a person, that is, he could formulate, he could evaluate, he could initiate. And because he was so brilliant, remember we're not yet in the gross material world, because he was so brilliant, the other angels who were round about were totally fascinated by him. They could see this magnificent being. Sometimes you get a punch in the eye from a friend accidentally. And when your eye, not many girls suffer from this, do they, unless they're married. But when, if you do get punched in the eye, you see a lot of lights, suddenly. I want you to imagine a sort of permanent punch in the eye, twinkling away, sparkle, sparkle, with every conceivable colour of the rainbow and any other kind of bows that we haven't yet seen in the gross world. You can reproduce it slightly, if you're careful, by putting the base of your palm on your eyeball and pressing it gently, please. I don't want to hear any horrible scrunches. If you do two hands like that, press and wait, you will find that the pressure on the eye stimulates the retina and colours will begin to appear. Have you done that before? Yeah, right. You can do it when you go home tonight in the dark room and gently press and wait patiently and press, press, press. Increase the pressure a bit. There's a certain amount of pressure, the correct amount. Don't do it too hard, not too soft, but just enough. And you'll see lights beginning to glow. It's like an aurora. It's like the beginning of dawn. And then it starts sparkling. And then you see lines of light flashing about. Physiologically, your retina is being stimulated by mechanical pressures. And you can make your head apparently full of light by this trick. I want you to take this image back and say this in a minute degree is what it was like to look at Lucifer. Your head will be full of light. Imagine you look at that spotlight. If I look at that light, it hurts me a bit. And relatively, everything round it goes black. So that if I saw a light buzzing at me like that, in those days, I would tend to go and admire it. Admire means hold the mirror to. Have a look at yourself, you bright thing. Now, I must warn all ministers of the gospel about this, because this is how he came to fall. Imagine this brilliant creature with no gross matter, no inertia, a personal intelligence able to think, feel and will, and he's surrounded by others, some of them quite bright, but they are looking at him and they're admiring him and thinking, how on earth does he do that? And by earth they don't mean gross earth in those days, they simply mean the substance of light. His body's a light substance, substantialized light. And he observes that they are watching him. This is where the warning to the ministers of the gospel starts. The tremendous admiration of the congregation can actually cause a fall in the representatives of God, if they don't watch it, into feeling spiritual. Imagine what it's like. Imagine you had a congregation of multiplying, and they were looking at you, and you knew you were bright. You could see yourself by looking down at your own beautiful thighs, and I mean beautiful because Lucifer had a really beautiful body, a body of light, iridescent, sparkling, wonderful. He also had another quality. He sounded, the Bible says, tabrets, musical instruments, little drums and pipes. I want you to think about that, because remember that sound is compression, decompression, alternation. Now imagine a sphere of light that is vibrating like this, and when it condenses itself a bit it goes bang. And at the same moment, a light correspondent with the sound flashes from it. It's the best kind of fairground hurdy-gurdy you've ever seen in your life. Just imagine it. Funkle, funkle, plink, plonk, 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 plink, plonk. Better quality than that. Imagine it. It is surrounded by other spheres, but not quite so brilliant. And they're all thinking, how does he do it? Now, this is their mistake. You can forgive them because they're not so bright. But he knows that he is the brightest, because wherever he looks, in infinity, nobody is outshining him. And he knows that they're admiring his brightness. But he also knows something else. That brightness is from the infinite. He himself did not make it. Think about that very carefully. He's conscious. He can think. He can feel. He can will. He can formulate. He can evaluate. And he can initiate. He knows that the power that's in him is from the infinite. He knows he's already brighter than every other angel. And he sees their worship. And remember that light is consciousness. And therefore he's the most conscious of all beings in that period. So relatively they are dimmer witted than he is. And what does he do? He falls into liking their admiration. The moment he does that, he's in trouble, because he thinks to himself, why not make myself a little bit lighter? I know this power is from the infinite. All I need to do is draw upon the infinite to make me brighter than I already am. Now this infinite is this same absolute God who made this angelic sphere. So what he's doing is calling God a bit of a fool. Because if God has made Lucifer so bright, if it had been safe to make him brighter, God would have done so, because God's very fond of brightness. God actually likes talents. He throws talents about all over the place. Have a talent. Have five, have ten, and develop them. He loves people with talents, and he loves them to develop. So if it had been safe to do so, God would have given even more power to Lucifer. But he didn't. Now, instead of respecting God's judgment in the matter, Lucifer thought, well, I can get a bit. Maybe he's holding a bit back. Maybe he doesn't want me to outshine him. Solomon Dunn Dunce. That's what Blake calls him. And that moment it becomes illogical. If that infinite is so smart as to make Lucifer, to generate that sphere, and if the infinite must remain infinite, how can a finite, no matter how bright, how can it take the infinite and posit infinity into the finite? It is illogical. So Lucifer shows himself a bad logician at that point, so we say he's a dunce. Now, he begins to draw this energy from the infinite. Already, he's got as much as can safely be borne. He's a brilliant, the most brilliant of all the archangels. And he draws more energy in, and it appears that he's going to get a bit lighter. But he also gets a bit hotter. Those of you who've done your O levels, and even A levels, know that when you start doing work, you start raising the temperature. Any lady with an egoist knows this, that if you whiz very fast, you can raise the temperature of the egg you're whisking. Can't you? You ever done that? Nice little experiment for ladies at home with a thermometer. Now, he becomes hot. But when things are hot, do they not expand a bit? But is he not already created by God of a certain dimension? So if within his appointed sphere he tries to draw in more energy and pack it into himself, but his bounds are appointed by the infinite, doesn't he do exactly the same thing that a car does if it overheats? He seizes up. And that's the logic of the situation. This most brilliant of all spheres, quite suddenly, from excess of light, darkness. That magnificent sphere of light suddenly goes zoom. It is now earth. It is choked with energy. It is now void. Think of that, formless. It has packed itself so solid, it has become the substance, the gross substance that we talk about and that we hammer when we hit things and stamp our feet on the ground. Through this process of acceptance of admiration from the congregation of angels, through his desire to be even brighter, he took in more than he could safely freely assimilate. And suddenly there was a great sphere there. Black. And at the moment that happened, his name changed from Lucifer to Satan. Satan means being snake. Satan. The worm that dieth not. Imagine this beautiful light sphere is now black. It is substantial. It is inertia. Now, what does the absolute God do with it? First of all, he made it free, able to do anything, and left it free so that it could develop its talents. And then quite suddenly, through this weird ambition to outshine its creator's intention, it has become a colossal sphere of cosmic substance. And then the book of Genesis starts. The Spirit of God moves on the surface of that sphere. Now Milton will tell you that when that devil fell, he drew with him in his proud weight 1/3 of the heavenly hosts. That means to say that all those that were in the immediate vicinity when he went cloying and made this substance, those who were too near were dragged in with him. Think of that very carefully. Some beings, remember, sentient power that thinks, feels and wills, is a person. Some beings, some personal intelligences, when that sphere of light condensed like that, were dragged into that sphere. So when God starts to work upon it, the Spirit, the Ruach of God, starts to work on this sphere, it begins to separate the light from the darkness. God separated the light from the darkness. He starts to separate out the trapped intelligences that were just standing about stupidly admiring him, who are later to be called the sheep of Christ. Those trapped intelligences who are dragged in have to be rescued. It's only fair to rescue them. Then he goes on and he separates and he makes land and seas and he creates animals, birds in the air, fish in the sea, trees. And finally, on his sixth performance, he makes man. Now, he forms man of the dust of the ground. That means to say, he forms man of a double principle. The Luciferan fallen body is satanic. Think carefully about this. As to your physical body, part of you is satanic, egotistic, wanting to be worshipped, contradicting God, saying he doesn't exist, I'm the bright boy, ignore the non-existent, concentrate on me. And the other part, the part that was trapped in accidentally, drawn in, that wants out, wants to be forgiven, wants to belong again to God. Now here's the source of Arthur's doubt. Part of us wants to go back to truth, beauty, goodness, divinity, the body of light, be free from inertia, be really free and creative. But the other part is satanic. And the satanic part continuously contradicts the other part. In your body, if you examine yourself carefully, you'll see the evidences. There are, inside your being, tendencies to violence, tendencies to destructiveness, to criticism of other people, to unloving acts. And then, sometimes even simultaneously with them, a feeling this is wrong. That the part that's feeling it is wrong to be violent, it is wrong to be jealous, it is wrong to be greedy, it is wrong to be conceited. That part is not the same part that is feeling, I wish I didn't have to be hurried like this. So a human being is already a doubting being, a double presentation being. Now what happens? There is this man, the first man ever made. He's posited in a garden called Eden, which means do not judge. Eden, the den root, means judgment. Don't judge. God is watching you. Don't judge. Do not pretend to know what good and evil is, because I, the Lord, have made you. If you believe in me, you will do as I say. Christ repeats this few centuries later. If you love me, do as I say. God says to Adam, now you don't know because you are not experienced. You are in a state called innocent. You just don't know anything. Now how do you train somebody who knows nothing? You tell them, don't do this, don't do that. So he's given a very simple little command. Don't eat of fruit that causes you to know what is good and what is evil, because I have only got the good for you. I don't want you to have the evil. A fellow you know nothing about called Lucifer made it, and your physical body has got that principle in it. But I want you not to waken up the evil in you. Now I'm going to test you and see if you will believe me. Don't presume to know what is good and evil. You are innocent. What happens? for some unknown reason, Adam is careless. He lets the wife walk about. She encounters a very subtle fellow, namely Satan, in the form of a serpent. The anthropologists say in the form of the phallus, in the form of the sexual stimulus. But that is not correct. What she encounters is the satanic memory inside herself, because she says, good to look at, pleasant to eat, and will confer wisdom like God. There's something in her wants to be as wise as God, but in order to fulfill private purposes, exactly satanic. And because she's a new being and doesn't think, she's not logical in her thought. She's just titillated by the idea presented. You will be as God, knowing good and evil, says that spirit. And that God is jealous of you. But that was what already Lucifer had said. Maybe God doesn't want me to shine too much. So he says to Eve, he is trying to stop you knowing as much as he knows, and he knows about evil. You get to know about it. She does it, she gives it to Adam. He is in trouble. He blames her, she blames the serpent. They all get thrown out. They get thrown out of the kingdom of non-judgment because they have judged. Now they know what evil is. It means a kick in the pants for acting stupidly. They are now out. Let's think carefully about this innocence. We see things in no sense, innocuously, non-poisonously, before we've had an experience. But we don't have to be disobedient just because we don't know anything, because we could have a feeling, because we think and feel and will. And we could evaluate with our feeling this fellow who says he's God, who says he created us, really did, and I feel that he's telling the truth. So if we really felt it, we'd have a super fine feeling evaluation, and we would say, this fellow means it. He really is warning me. Whatever it means, I don't know, but I'm going to obey him. And then Adam and Eve would have kept their balance, and the whole evolution of the world would have been quite different. Now, their imagination lusted after wisdom like God's, after power. Their imagination. And what is imagination? The word is from a Persian word meaning will. Spell it M-U-G-H, if you like. The Magi, Magi, that went to see Christ. The same word is from the same root. And the Mach in stomach is the same word, and the German word Magen is the same word. The power that is in your tummy, Magia, is the power that imaginates. Now you know that below your navel, a couple of inches down, except in short leg folk, and you could allow 1.5 inches, and roughly a couple of inches below the navel, halfway between your front and back parts, there is a centre of power. And this power, called in Japanese Zen Hara, H-A-R-A, this centre of power is a peculiar power. It's just like the power of God the Father. We're going to equate God the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost with our three parts. God the Father is in the Hara center, and he is a power that can, by a simple process of self-condensation, imaginate, that is, bring to be that which was not formed into a form. Imagine a free power floating, but imagine that free power can mobilize itself. It can formulate itself into a sphere. And then when it does so, we say it has imaginated itself. It has formed itself. Would you believe that nearly all the pains that the human race suffer from are imaginary in this sense? It's Supposing we get hit by a passing car and we have a pain. What is the pain for? To warn us that we're damaged. Yeah? Once we have been warned, do we need the pain? We could do without it. But supposing it has sales value to other people. My God, look what you've done. Oh, you owe me £5,000 now. You'd be surprised how many accidents results are prolonged over lawsuits because of this marvellous power of imagination. The same power that the hypnotist studied, that Mesmer studied as animal magnetism. In the centre of that tam of yours, right down in the tomb, is a power that can resurrect. And it can formulate. And it can evaluate. Now this power can do it in one of two ways. Egotistically, for private reasons, or divinely inspired for God's reasons. The same power can be used for good or evil. Just like fire is a good servant in the great and a bad master in your life. There is no power, no energy that cannot be used for either good or evil. Nuclear power can be used to wipe out civilization's major cities in an hour. Or it could be used to generate electricity cheaply. It won't be, of course. Not for a long time, the millennium. But it can be. In the same way, this tumpa, the dumo of the Tibetans, this lower abdominal heat, the same heat that you feel stirring in a sexually stimulating situation. That same energy is imagination power. By this imagination power, the absolute God created the world. By this same power, a genius creates an idea. By this same power, a positive man subdues his girlfriend. By this same power, a seductress immobilizes politicians. There is only power self-formulating, and in its process of self-formulating, its old name, quite simply, is imagination. When modern psychology talks about creative imagination, it's talking about using the same power in a process of meditation to design something worth designing. But the same power could actually shatter you and destroy your health if it were profitable so to do for a time. Now we want to talk about how to equate the fatherhood and the imaginative power of the human being and recognize its source. The body of man is made of earth, but, as it says in the Genesis story, God breathed his spirit into man, and man became thereby a living soul. Now, nefesh, the spirit of life. But that nefesh, you find in the animal. It has to be converted to another form called ruach, the rock that flew about with Sinbad. The same spirit of life, if it becomes reflexive, that is, if it knows what it's doing continuously, if it becomes reflexive, it becomes ruach, R-U-A-C-H, the word used in the Bible for the spirit of God. This word means differentiation power. That letter R, the resh, means differentiation. The ach means the power. The power of conscious self-differentiation is ruach. It is the same power that is nefesh in an animal, that is simply being alive. You know that animals have a body and a soul, because animal is from anima equals soul. But they have not converted their anima into ruach, into spirit, because they have not made it reflexive. So when the doggy admires its mistress, the admiration comes out and it doesn't go back. It doesn't go to the object and return to the dog. It's fixated on the dog owner. So that power can be trapped in the object worshipped. And it does not then return to the one that sent it out. Now in the control of the imagination, we must learn that we ourselves are the masters of our own destiny. By divine permission. God breathed his spirit into man. Man became a living soul. God told man to wake up, get alerted. Christ keeps saying it over and over again, wake up. You're dead. Every time you worship an external object, you are dead. Tied up, identified. You have forgotten to return. God always returns to himself, and that's why he remains God. If he didn't return when he made an act of creation, he would be involved in creation. He would be a material world and be able to do nothing about it and not be able to reclaim it. But to become a father is to control one's imagination so that one can actually have a dialogue. I mean, it's quite serious, not a figure of speech. Because person means think, feel, will, trine, power, able to formulate, evaluate, and initiate, God is a person. He is said to have three persons in this one God, because he can think. He said that's a God, the ability to think. God and good are the same word. It is good to be able to formulate. Also, it is good to be able to evaluate. Also, it is good to be able to initiate. So this threefold God, this trine God, has breathed his spirit into man. So the man himself is a trine God. Christ says, is it not written? Ye are gods. Don't accuse me of blasphemy. If I say I, here, now, am God, you are God. William Blake says, I'm God, you're God, and so is he. Everybody is God. Christ says, Billy Blake, stop talking carelessly. You are only the child of the power to which you give yourself. If you give yourself to that infinite God power and work from that, you are a child of that God. But if you give yourself to the imaginated ego structure, as Lucifer did, then you are a child of the devil. Because this child means the way power chops itself. You have divided yourself from infinity by your own imagination. Now, how do we control this imagination? The first thing we have to do is become aware that we actually live by it. Now, we are said in the book with the black back, sometimes it has a white back. These new perspex, you can have it any color you like. The imagination controls the universe. The imagination is the power of God. It is the I-making power. How do you control it? First of all, you must become aware that it is controlling you. You have to believe this, and this is an act of faith. Now, without faith, it is impossible to please God. You know, it says, not by works are you saved, lest any man boast. It doesn't matter how many good deeds you do, if you do them from egotistic intention, they are not counted for you. They are counted against you. But if you do exactly the same deeds from identification with the infinite, if you say, whatever I can do is a talent conferred upon me from the infinite, and it is my deep appreciation of this conferred talent and my adoration for the infinite that gave me the power to use this talent. In my admiration for this infinite power, I develop my talent. That's okay. You can become a genius. You can do what you like. For God's sake. But if you say, I'm a finite being and by my own efforts I became mighty, And I fought my way from the bottom to the top until I was called Lord Feather in my own right. When you do this, you have fallen. You have forgotten that it was infinity that gave the power to the finite. Now, if you watch inside yourself, you will find two kinds of imagination. The imagination that egotizes and that plots incessantly. How can I become famous? How can I get out of the red? How can I do a marvelous work of art? How can I sing, dance, anything? How can I force everybody to recognize me? Rather funnily, I saw a bit of Sammy Davis Jr. last night on the TV. Did anybody else see him? Years ago, that boy was so conceited that it was terrible to watch him. But I don't like inertia, so I watched him again. And it was marvelous to see the change in him. He had actually discovered that he's better being himself with the talents given to him than trying to mimic everybody else. He said, what I want to be, and he pointed up. When he lost his eye in a car crash, he said, he up there adjusted my one eye to wide-angle vision. And he pointed up. And he wasn't joking, like some people might. He meant that he was aware that it was not Sammy Davis Jr. that went from narrow vision with only one eye. At a certain critical point, his vision changed. He was able to drive the car safely. And he knew it was not the egotism of Sammy Davis Jr. that had adjusted his eye because he didn't know enough about optics. Something had adjusted it. And he said, he did it. He was aware that there is a power that is not egotistic and is working for the good of the human being. And he acknowledged that power. That was marvelous. And then when he sang better, with less mannerism, less trickery, less showmanship, and more him. He was trying to be himself, and somebody had been teaching him how to breathe. He used to sing a lot in the throat and do a lot of head wobbling to get a vibrato. Now he was standing on his diaphragm and singing quite low, abdominally, getting near to the generative power. He was a lot better. If he goes on like that, and I'm quite confident he will, because once you've seen a thing is better than another thing, you tend to do it and not let go of it. But he will go on improving and becoming more and more him. So instead of degenerating, he will improve. He'll actually get better as he gets older instead of worse. When we look inside ourselves, we find a power that is imaginating all the time. We have a thought process, if we don't stop it, and it's forever manipulating and doing silly things, thinking up schemes of betterment, new decorations, new furniture, new this, new cars, new everything. Everything has to be new. And simultaneously with it, there's another imagination thinking, this is rubbish. Ignore it. I have a real internal talent conferred upon me by the Absolute. And it is my absolute duty to develop this talent given to me by the Infinite rather than copy the successes of external beings. And then you're on the spot. You're between two beings. St. Paul puts it very simply. The spirit, that Ruach, lusts against the flesh and the flesh lusts against the spirit. There is a war on in your body between egotism and its plans and real knowledge that we are in possession of the infinite power that God has given us to develop our talents through the imagination. So then we can choose to imagine in the plan that God has for each one of us, or we can choose to imagine particularized schemes of manipulation for ego private benefit. And we have to choose. If we waffle about in between, We remain wafflers. We have chosen waffling. We can't not choose. This is a terrible thing. We're either for the infinite, for the finite, or for waffling. Waffling is not a non-choice. It's a choice to waffle. It says in the book about those, the wafflers shall be spewed out of the mouth. Because they won't learn, except waffling. You see, if you choose pure egotization, you'll become what the world calls a great man, a Napoleon, and you'll have your end, St. Helena, or something like that. You will learn. And if you choose to obey God, you will learn. Everybody will start thumping you and calling you wicked and doing things like that. Whether you commit yourself to the finite or the infinite, you will learn something worth learning. If you commit yourself to the wafflery, you'll learn nothing except waffling. And God doesn't like them, so he spews them out of the mouth. Because they are not developing their talents. They're not even providing good opposition so that other people can develop their talents against you. You are a father when you consciously, reflexively generate and put something into being that was not there before. And you are a master of creative imagination when you know, I don't mean hope or think, when you know that you are able to imagine, create. I want you just to do a simple thing. Hold your hand like that and then imagine it closed. See what happens when you've got your hand open and you imagine it closed, and tell me what it's like. Can you feel it? If you're not careful, it'll close. Yes? It's a funny thing then, isn't it? We live in a field of infinite power. This power is imagination. The eye-making power. We have been conditioned by education into externalization to destroy our imaginative power. Because if we are really imaginative, creative, we cannot be controlled from outside. Now it's quite obvious that we, in our childhood and in our delinquency, in our adolescence, we need controlling. So there has to be a power on earth to control the child. But that power goes on and on and on, miseducating people into thinking that they can only act by thinking rationally. And that the laws of reason have been laid down by Aristotle for you, and that you must obey them. Now that is the only way that a society can hold a group of people together initially. But it is not the way a society is going to be held together in its maturity. In its maturity, every member of that society will know his imaginative power. He will know that he can create or destroy. And he will know that cooperation is better than continuous mutual refutation. In those days, no man will need another to tell him about God, because all shall know him. That is to say, this fundamental imaginative power, which is God the Father, will be reflexive in the human being, because the human being has worked to develop the talent given to him to become reflexive, and he will be able to imagine it, to bring forth by power, to model his field, the biomagnetic field of his body, and to create situations so that there will be a new kind of earth. In those days, the whole earth will be a garden. Everything about it will be worth having, because it will be a product of reflexive, self-conscious imagination. After you've had your refreshment, we will discuss the relationship between energy and the power of consciousness.